Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Problems at 3 nuclear reactors in Japan, explosions, major evacuations, continuing aftershocks to boot, and the major sacrificial decision to cool the exposed rods with seawater, which will destroy the reactors. Still, most experts have said that there's plenty of cause for concern, not for alarm. What's the difference? And when should concern turn into alarm? Coming up later, we'll hear from Richard Denning. He's an OSU professor of nuclear engineering and also a senior research leader at Battelle's Columbus Laboratories. Joining us now to continue the conversation about Japan after the devastating earthquake and tsunami on Friday is Mark Fischetti. He is the editor in charge of environmental and energy coverage for Scientific America. He was managing editor of the magazine's Earth 3.0 special editions and helped launch Scientific America Mind. His 2001 article, Drowning New Orleans, predicted the widespread disaster that a storm like Hurricane Katrina would cause. He has appeared on CNN, NBC's Meet the Press, the History Channel, and NPR News. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hi, Ann. Thanks.
How's the media coverage been so far of the problems at the nuclear reactors in Japan?
The media coverage, I'm glad to say, has been pretty calculated, which is a good thing in this case. Most of the major media outlets are drawing on experts, and I'm glad to see that most of them are saying, you know, as far as we know, based on reported evidence, it's really difficult in these kind of situations to get actual data from the site because it's just no one's there to collect it or to spread it around. So I think the coverage has been pretty fair. There's definitely, as you were just saying, this difference between alarm and concern. I think most media have been walking that line pretty well. I would say if you go to scientificamerican.com, we have a lot of new material up there, and it's constantly updated. And if you're interested in all kinds of details, you can find it there.
Okay, we'll post scientificamerica.com at our website at wosu.org/allsides. My guest is Mark Fischetti. He is the editor at Scientific America in charge of environment and energy. If you have a question or comment for Mark, he's only going to be with us for the first segment, so get your questions in early, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and make your point there. How much in these kinds of situations, Mark, does the media actually, how much is the media actually told about the problems when it comes to things like nuclear reactors?
Well, in this case, most of the broadcast media are depending on NHK TV, which is the television's kind of nationalized in Japan, so it's one of the national stations. The footage that you see, and the reason you see the same footage over and over again is because that's really the only feed that you're getting of the reactors, you know. And there's not much else to go on, so what you generally do is find experts who are familiar with the types of reactors and the types of incidents that can happen. The reactors, in this case, are boiling water reactors. They're made by General Electric. It's a kind of standard design. There's more than 20 of them in the U.S. So you can tell a lot, and there's also in the U.S. in particular a lot of training scenarios about, you know, if certain things go wrong, what happens. So you can tell a lot by putting together reports with what you do know about these kinds of reactors and exercises that are done regularly to react to potential disasters.
Early on Tuesday in Japan, the power plant in the country's northeast was rocked by an explosion at the number 2 reactor. That's the third blast at that site in 4 days. It was followed by a fire that broke out at the number 4 reactor unit, which appeared to be the cause of today's radiation leaks. If there's nobody there collecting the data, Mark, who's there putting out the fires?
Well, you know, the reports is that there are maybe 50 personnel, you know, who are there trying to handle the situation. Mm-hmm. Everyone else has been dismissed. You know, they, of course, are monitoring radiation levels for their own safety. But other than that, as you might imagine, they're scrambling to do whatever they can do since there's been so much damage because of the earthquake and the tsunami. So there's no one feeding reports of information outside. there probably is to the Japanese government, I would imagine, and to, you know, safety officials. But right now, they're not really concerned on site with what the media knows. They just got to do what they can to keep the reactors from getting worse.
My guest is Mark Fischetti of Scientific America. If you have any questions or comments for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Scott from Hilliard, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like your guest to give us an overview of Chernobyl, Three Mile, and what might happen in Japan and how they differ. And if I could, just a quick question. The radiation that they consider harmful levels, is there a consensus on that? And could he talk a little bit about that? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Chernobyl, Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, that was 1979. Chernobyl is 1986. Three Mile Island was somewhat like this in that there was power losses and the ability to cool the reactor started to be lost. So there was some melting of the fuel, but there's containment vessels around the reactor. And there was a slightly release of radiation, but they basically brought the reactor under control. There weren't any great releases of radiation, and the reactor was damaged enough that it was put out of commission, and that was that. Chernobyl in Soviet Union did not have these kind of containment structures that we have in the U.S. or that Japan has in this current case. They had a much more dangerous situation, and the reactor core essentially melted down, and all that radiation was exposed because they did not have the proper kinds of containment that we do in other areas. So the radiation release there was far more than at anywhere else, and I would say it's safe to say it was far more than would possibly happen in Japan now. The danger for a region close to the reactor, but you know, depending on the wind patterns, the radiation plume can be taken hundreds or even thousands of miles over time. It dissipates as it gets further. And in Chernobyl's case, it was 7 or 8 days. Some small levels of radiation in the upper atmosphere had circulated all the way around the planet, but they're so diffused at that point that they're not really a threat to anyone. The Japan situation is more like Three Mile Island than Chernobyl, certainly. Radiation, again, there's more being released in this situation, and part of that is to blow off steam, as they say, so that there isn't more catastrophic explosions than the small ones they've had. That's something that has to be monitored. There are certainly safety officials around the region monitoring the air. And you may have heard that the USS Reagan ship that was offshore, they were suddenly found themselves, you know, they're monitoring the air. They found themselves in a plume of radiation and decided to move for safety for the moment. Now, these have been isolated events, as we heard, and they dissipate somewhat quickly. But, you know, more events can occur.
Thanks for that call, Scott. Don from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I was wondering with the nuclear plants in Ohio, I know there's one up on Lake Erie in Moscow, I can't remember exactly where that is. How old are they? And I know they're, I don't guess they're in earthquake fault areas that I know of. Are the salt caverns under Lake Erie or coal mines in Ohio suitable storage facilities? Because right now, some of these plants in Japan the pools are melting down. It appears that the rods are melting down in the pools. How do you deal with that? And I also remember Battelle's got a nuclear reactor over in West Jeff. Is that still operational?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Don. I don't know how much of that Mark can answer. He's not an expert on Ohio. But what are the sorts of questions that we should be asking, Mark?
Well, I can give you a little bit of an answer anyway. And by the way, again, if you go to Scientific American with an N, .com, there's more in Chernobyl and Three Mile Island there as well. There's 104 reactors in the United States that are operating. Most of them are fairly old. There hasn't been a new reactor built in decades because of the Three Mile Island accident. After that, the pending applications, one by one, were taken down. So most of the reactors are fairly old. They're designed to run for 30 or 40 years, and then there are steps that could be taken and regulations that can be approved to let them continue longer. I don't think the age is really a concern. The safety containment structures that are used today are similar to what were being used then. As far as being on fault, there are a couple of reactors in California that are close to San Andreas Fault. They're not on it, but they're pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, there may be one or two. I can't say for sure, but there's not many. And those ones that are designed to withstand earthquakes. And so are these in Japan, though, I should say. But the magnitude of the earthquake is so extreme. And then the tsunami following right after it is pretty unusual. So they probably got more than they bargained for, given the magnitude of the earthquake.
Thank you, Don, for that call. I wanted to ask about the issue of the relationship between the earthquake and the tsunami. You said it's quite unusual, but tsunamis are often triggered by earthquakes.
Yeah, it's a question of magnitude. So this is, the fifth largest earthquake in a century anywhere on planet Earth. And so the tsunami is one of the largest in recorded history as well. And the fact that they happened in a place that was really close to nuclear reactors that are really close to the ocean, the circumstances get kind of unusual when you put all these factors together. That said, it certainly was possible, and there will be questions, I'm sure, and inquiries about how well some of the safety features were designed. The reason that all this trouble began was that the electrical power lines were lost due to the earthquake, and then there's backup diesel generators, but from what I understand, those were lost because of the tsunami,
mm-hmm.
and there's some question about whether those generators could have been built underground with certain kinds of exhaust systems so that they could operate in flooded waters. I don't know too much about that, but those kinds of things, there'll be lots of aftermath, and those kinds of things will come out, and they may affect designs or retrofits in plants around the world.
What's the chit-chat out there, Mark, about doubts about nuclear energy or expanding the use of nuclear power in the United States now?
Yeah.
It was gaining some steam, no pun intended, and now
it was. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it was, for many years, people just wrote it off, but it really was gaining some steam, and there are still about 20 new applications to build nuclear reactors in the U.S. after being none for many years.
Mm-hmm.
20 reactors, not necessarily 20 different locations. Two ground has been broken for two of them, one in Georgia and one in South Carolina, just the very early stages, breaking ground, literally. This is not going to help the case, the business case, and certainly not the public perception case for nuclear power. It really could put the brakes on it once again.
My guest, Mark Fischetti, he is an editor in charge of environmental and energy coverage for Scientific American. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Appreciate it. When we return, we're going to bring on Richard Denning. He's a professor of nuclear energy at OSU and senior research leader of Battelle's Columbus Laboratory. So stay with us. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. Join WOSU-TV tonight for an all-new Victor Borge television special. The show features his funniest and most memorable skits. And Victor always said that a smile is the shortest distance between people. Treat yourself to a big dose of laughter and side-splitting comedy routines. Watch Victor Borge, 100 Years of Music and Laughter, tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Thurber House, presenting a special evening with Susie Orman, discussing her new book, The Money Class, Learn to Create Your New American Dream, Wednesday, March 16th at COSI. Tickets at 464-1032.
42 degrees in downtown Columbus. Rain today, a high of 48. Rain likely tonight, and a low of 39 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Joining us now is Richard Denning. He's a professor of nuclear engineering at Ohio State University and formerly a senior research leader of Battelle's Columbus Laboratories. Richard has been a principal contributor to the development of methods for analyzing the severe risks and the risk-informed regulation of nuclear power plants. He has been a member of the Department of Energy's Advisory Committee on Nuclear Facility Safety and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards. Welcome to the show, Rich.
Hi.
The New York Times noted that American nuclear plants share some or all of the risk factors of their Japanese counterparts, and that like these Japanese plants, they're built to withstand earthquakes and tsunamis, but the 1-2 punch of both phenomena was beyond the imagination of planet designers. Why is that beyond their imagination if tsunamis typically are triggered by earthquakes, among other things? Why would a 1-2 punch be beyond the imagination of nuclear plant designers?
Yeah, it wasn't really beyond the imagination of nuclear plant designers. The comments about sharing the vulnerabilities, I think that it is clear that the tsunami was a major element here. So if there's any serious relooking at criteria, I'm sure every plant that's built on an ocean site, and there aren't that many in the United States, that there's going to be a serious look again at what the design basis is for that. The Japanese plant, and this is all information that I've been learning over the last couple of days. Mm-hmm. Japanese plant truly was built to withstand both a seismic event and an associated tsunami. The problem was that the level of seismic event was less than what actually occurred. I mean, obviously we have an event that's once in the existence of Japan. I think it's the largest event of this kind that's ever occurred in Japan. Mm-hmm. So that were one to do it over again, I'm sure they would have gone for a larger design basis. But there was a design basis against the tsunami, and it clearly wasn't enough. And so I think that it was also higher than, of course, they're shaking. You know, normally when we think of seismic events, we're not thinking of tsunamis unless you're on a coastal location, and so we worry primarily about the shaking of the plant. Can it withstand the shaking? It certainly sounds like it was able, even though the event that actually occurred was larger than the design basis that they had. It seems that the plant was actually able to withstand that, had enough margin beyond what we call the safe shutdown earthquake, that it was able to withstand that. But it was the tsunami that was just greater than the abilities that they had provided for protection of that cooling equipment. And, of course, it was a major double whammy with regards to having taken out so many systems that are essential for the cooling of the plant there. We look a lot at this kind of accident, what we call a station blackout accident, where you've lost off-site power, you go to your diesel generators. For some reason, the diesel generators don't work. Now, typically, we're not in a situation like the tsunami, mm-hmm. where there's a clear mechanistic reason why the diesel generators, which started okay and then when the tsunami hit, were gone. So we look a lot at that particular kind of accident for both our pressurized water reactors and our boiling water reactors to determine what would you really do in a situation like that. In their case, I mean, they're so hamstrung with the options that they have available to them that it's extremely difficult for them.
To what extent can what we learn from this experience be applied around the world? You said that we don't have that many nuclear power plants in Oceanside in the United States, but we do have some, and there are others around the world. Once a nuclear power plant is built, to what extent can it be modified to take into account what we learned from this?
I do think that it can be significantly modified if it's deemed necessary, and I think one has to look at the seismicity in a region and make a determination as to could one really anticipate a earthquake and tsunami of that level. But clearly when you're starting off and building a plant, mm-hmm. you can definitely protect against it. As far as tsunamis are concerned, you can certainly imagine constructing structures that would provide protection for essential equipment above and beyond what is currently there. I mean, we saw buildings being swept away and things like that, but you can build a very strong structure. So, and now I'm getting a little bit outside of my area of expertise and haven't really thought about what would you do to backfit a plant if you decided that indeed we should have extra protection against particularly the tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there are things that you can do even with an existing plant.
Problems at three nuclear reactors in Japan now have led to news reports that range from reassuring to terrifying. But experts on nuclear accidents say there's plenty of cause for concern, not for alarm. Where do you fall along that continuum yourself?
I definitely in that there's significant concern. I still have significant concern that things could get worse from the condition that they're currently in, and that one could be in a situation. It's obvious that there's a significant amount of fuel damage that has occurred already, significant amount of radionuclide release from the fuel. But one of the real benefits of this particular kind of design, the boiling water reactor, is when we do our severe accident analyses, is that the suppression pool and the water in the suppression pool, it has a very large effect in mitigating the consequences, capturing the things that we worry about, like the iodine and the cesium that are released. And so that gives me comfort. Unit 2 now apparently has lost their suppression pool, and so that if things get worse in that particular unit, I think we would see a larger release from that unit than if things got bad in any of the other units. But with regards to I think you have to put in perspective what the potential radiological consequences are, and they are not that members of the public that are offsite. There's not going to be a release of radionuclides that's large enough that would lead to those people getting radiation sickness and dying. The level just is not going to be that large, and we've evacuated out from the area that's in close to the plant where you would expect that as a possibility. But under the conditions that we're currently on, if things mm-hmm. got worse, and I've done a lot of analyses of these types of severe accident situations, it just is not credible that you're going to have people dying, members of the public dying from radiation sickness. Now, they can be exposed, and if you want me to go on and talk a little bit about that, I'll talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I just want to remind folks we're talking, of course, about the problems with the nuclear reactors in Japan after the earthquake and tsunami on Friday. My guest right now is Richard Denning. He's a professor of nuclear engineering at Ohio State University, formerly a senior research leader of Battelle's Columbus Laboratories and principal contributor to the development of methods for analyzing the severe risks and the risk-informed regulation of nuclear power plants. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Rich, yeah, I'd like to know about the impact of the radiation, not just on humans, but what about – is it different for humans than it is for other species?
animals and things like that. No, I think the real concern is humans, and the real health concern is that there could be exposures that could lead to a probability in the future that they could get, like 7 or 15 years in the future, they would have a higher probability of getting cancer,
right,
potentially dying from cancer. But I think that one thing that's very clear is that if that were to happen, you wouldn't actually be able to observe it epidemiologically. That is, you wouldn't be able to go later and look and say, well, did this accident really lead to greater numbers of leukemia or things like that than you would expect to see in that population? And I think that it's clear from Chernobyl, where there was this huge release,
right,
that the only observable there was thyroid cancers in children, and that obviously was a very bad thing.
It would have to be a specific kind of cancer, though, that you could link that way, or
it isn't just that the problem there was they got very large exposures, and for that particular cancer, it was observable. But things like leukemia are not observable in the Ukrainian and Belarusian populations just because there's so much background. As far as the thyroid cancer which we saw in children in Belarus and Ukraine, I don't think we would see that in Japan because they were prepared to give this therapeutic potassium iodide that would effectively blocks the pickup of iodine.
Mm-hmm.
So my bigger concern is land contamination by cesium. I mean, this is a small country, and if we were to have a continued release, there is some potential for land contamination.
What does land contamination mean?
Well, I mean that you would have cesium depositing on the ground in farmland areas where you wouldn't be able to farm that area until the cesium had died away, or these things have radioactive half-lives in which they with time go away. Cesium has a very long half-life, a 30-year half-life, and that in the very close-in neighborhood of Chernobyl, that's the thing that now prevents people from coming back and living in the city there.
Mm-hmm.
It's land contamination from cesium. So that's a greater concern to me than the population exposure,
okay,
because if you look at the tragedy that's occurred there already with the number of fatalities, this isn't really going to lead, even if things go bad from here, it's not going to lead to more people immediately dying. And as I said before, it could lead to an increased possibility for cancers in the future, but it's a fraction of the risk they already have from dying from cancer from other causes, a small enough fraction that you just, in the future, 10, 15 years, people look back, they're not going to see any increased cancers there. So I think that's why land contamination, in my mind, is perhaps the bigger concern than the immediate human health effects.
Dan from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Is that what you wanted to ask about regarding radioactive residue?
Well, it partially addressed
okay.
it. I do have a question, and thank you very much. I have a question about some of the longer half-life elements, and I am not a chemist or a physicist, so I just only have general knowledge from reading the papers. But my understanding is that some of the elements that could be generated from a reaction, especially one that's not under proper control, could have very much longer half-lives than the cesium or strontium. And I heard that there is a suspicion that there might even have been plutonium involved in some of the products of these plants, the byproducts of these plants. And I guess, so my first question is, how frequent could it be expected that some long half-life isotopes could be produced from nuclear reactors, either accidentally or on purpose? And then secondly, how is that included in equations of risk. For instance, I mean, there could be an incredibly remote possibility of, I don't know, a meteor hitting and creating a very large tsunami that could even envelop a larger part of the country, which, of course, are ridiculous to even think about unless you unless some of these really long-term risks could be involved. And in that case, we're talking about mutagenesis, carcinogenesis, and things that, I mean, really have a could have a very heavy impact on the shape of our species.
Yeah, let me address that, because I think I understand your concerns, but in reality, that isn't as much as a problem as you might think. So let me first address the question of the longer-lived half-lives and in particular, plutonium. In just our normal operation of reactors as we do it in the United States, there is plutonium that's actually produced and is part of what we call the radioactive source term if you have an accident, because they don't evaporate at the temperatures. They have what we say low volatility. You don't get much release from them of those particular species, but they are included when we do our calculations of offsite consequences. They can be a minor contributor to what we call early effects. If we see any contribution from things like plutonium, its potential for being deposited on the ground, and because they're around for a long period of time, then years in the future they can be resuspended in dust. But what we really see is they just aren't the serious contributor to health effects. As far as mutagenesis and that type of thing, we just don't see any of that in ours. We have a pretty good understanding of all the things that are potentially cancer-causing. Radiation is the one that's probably been most studied and is best understood, and we just don't see that kind of thing happening. So this kind of thing is not going to lead to changes in ecosystems and new species and things like that. It's just that just is not going to happen from the kind of release that we're talking about.
Okay.
Another thing, and that is, I think one of these reactors has recycled plutonium in it as well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is just going through its approach towards analyzing the release of radioactive materials in severe accidents and looking carefully at this question of if we add plutonium. So we produce plutonium and it's burned all the time. So it's always there in our current reactors. But if you had more plutonium, and the reason that we might have more plutonium is that we're taking bombs and disassembling them. I mean, this is the good news, and taking the plutonium out of them, and we're going to recycle that in some nuclear power plant. So the question is, does that make them riskier?
Huh.
And so there are groups, and I'm on a group that is reviewing the changes in regulations that the NRC would have. It's not really regulations, but it's the approach towards assessing how much would be released in a severe accident. And there is some data on mixed oxide fuels and what would happen. These are fuels that have plutonium added, and we just don't see any significant difference in the release fractions in accidents of this type. So I think, you know, the plutonium is indeed there. It is a contributor that when we do our calculations and look and see what happens, and we look not just at the cloud that passes and you breathe it in and have it taken into your body that way, but we look at foods and stuff like that and see those pathways by which humans could be exposed.
We have to take another break.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. My guest is Richard Denning. He's professor of nuclear energy engineering, at OSU. He's been a principal contributor to the development of methods for analyzing the severe risks and the risk-informed regulation of nuclear power plants. If you have a question or comment for Rich, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. On Fresh Air, you'll hear the questions you wish you could have asked to people like Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Did it help to hear what your voice sounded like on helium? Did you learn something about your voice you didn't know before?
Yeah, I learned that I don't really need the helium.
Because it's pretty easy to flick that switch and go right up there.
The most interesting people in show business on Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes on today's edition of Fresh Air, a conversation with director, writer, and actor Tom McCarthy about his new feature film, Win-Win. Join us for Fresh Air beginning at noon.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover WOSU Public Media.
There are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or find us on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter at WOSU.org/email. And WOSU Public Media presents the Columbus Metropolitan Club's Wednesday Forum. Wednesday at noon, it's Ohio's new budget, featuring a panel of experts to analyze Governor John Kasich's first two-year state budget. Tickets and more information at columbusmetroclub.org. Rain likely off and on throughout the day today and a high of 48 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking about the risks associated with the problems at the Japanese nuclear power plant that was hit by fire in a third explosion early today, subsequent to the tsunami and the earthquake on Friday. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest right now and for the rest of the program is Richard Denning. He's a professor of nuclear engineering at Ohio State University and has been a principal contributor to the development of methods for analyzing the severe risks and the risk-informed regulation of nuclear power plants. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or go on to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Let's go back to, Rich, the explosions at Unit 1 on Saturday and Unit 3 on Monday, as well as explosions at Unit 4 and Unit 2 on Tuesday, were all likely caused by, they say, hydrogen buildup as a result of emergency attempts to cool the reactor cores. My question is, likely? What else could cause the explosions?
I can't imagine anything else to cause the explosion. There's no question in my mind that the hydrogen is associated with the degrading core, and it comes from a reaction between steam and zirconium that produces the hydrogen.
In light of this, how much do we actually know about what's happening inside the reactor?
We know very well. We know that the reactor's been tortured, that's for sure, because we do have and a lot of the information that we have is secondhand. The best information is definitely the information that has come from the utility, but that tends to be very terse. They don't go into great detail about what they're doing, but they have been communicating just what the status is. Now, so
do they have cameras or something measuring in there that actually works?
There are things. It's clear that they have pressure measurements that are working. With regards to what's going on in that reactor, it undoubtedly looks an awful lot like the Three Mile Island reactor looked when we disassembled it years after the event. So what's happened is there's a great deal of oxidation of the zirconium. There's been melting and relocation of fuel, almost certainly as a result of these extended periods when the core's been partially uncovered, but there are also very likely there are parts of the fuel rods that have never gotten hot, so that if things got worse, there probably is still some fuel that still could melt and release radionuclides that would be a potential hazard, and one would be worried about making sure that you try that we can mitigate this as best as we can. And mitigation means getting water in there. So every effort they can get to get water into the core region, into the containment, which is outside of the core, but is not that building that you see on the outside. The containment is a structure that's inside of that building. So that's what the key things to do.
The idea that in the event of a failure, a power failure, cooling water failure, or whatever, the cooling rods are supposed to fail by falling down out of the core, right?
No.
Okay.
No. No, in the event of loss of power.
Okay.
Let's pick loss of power because that's very applicable to this.
Okay.
There are control rods that are are actually blades in the they are cruciform blades. It may be hard for people to visualize what that means, but they in a boiling water reactor, they're inserted from the bottom and they go up into the core. Okay. And in the event of so in order to shut the reactor down, what you do is you insert those. Okay. Now mm-hmm. you can understand that in a pressurized water reactor, what we have is rods up on top, and when we lose electric power, what happens? They drop under gravity into the core. For the boiling water reactor, what we have are we have pressurized systems that because of the pressurization, it forces the rods up into the core in the event of that you have to quickly shut the reactor down. So there is no problem with that system. The control blades were inserted up into the core mm-hmm. and shut off the nuclear chain reaction. But of course, as everybody that's been following us knows by now, after you shut off the chain reaction, you still have what we call decay heat from the radioactive fission product.
They were already lit up in the first place.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. So and that dies away fairly rapidly, but it still is. That's why we have to keep water there, is because there's so much heat generated in these plants that even though that's just a small fraction now of that heat, you have to continue to cool it.
There, early on, they were saying the thought of flooding the reactors with cooling them using seawater was out of the question. Now it's, hey, if they can figure out how to do it, they're going to do it. The salt water destroys the reactors, right, over time?
Yes. Those reactors would never be used again.
So if that's the case, does that have any long-term effect on the radiation that's inside them now, what's happening right now? Or once that goes away, they'll be safe? How do you deconstruct a nuclear power plant, I guess?
Well, in order to deconstruct it, you have to use remote equipment. It's the way we did it at Three Mile Island. You use remote equipment. You would definitely have flooded the reactor well up above the reactor that you're defueling, and you have to go in with diamond drills and stuff like that and saws, diamond tip saws, to cut it up and take it out. There's no question that facing the Japanese, there's going to be a major problem like we had at Three Mile Island, where they're going to have to basically disassemble that remotely and then dispose of the waste. It's not an easy task, but it's definitely a manageable task that can be done without overexposure of personnel in doing it. It's all done remotely, but I think we definitely found that we were able to do it for Three Mile Island.
If you would like to speak to our guest, Richard Denning, OSU Nuclear Engineering Professor, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513. And John from Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, John.
I would like to know, from the standpoint of safety and practicality, would thorium have been better than uranium for these plants?
No, it would not actually. But let me explain for the viewers exactly what would happen with thorium. So basically, the plants that we have that operate are based on the fission of uranium, and only a very small fraction of uranium is fissionable. They're two different kinds of uranium, uranium-235 and uranium-238. And so what we do is we enrich the U-235 to about 4% of the total uranium. And when we do that, it can fission and produce power. And that's the way we do it. If you were going to use thorium, thorium can be converted into uranium-233 by a nuclear reaction. So what you would have to do is you would have to put it in a reactor that you would probably start up with your enriched uranium. And then you would convert the thorium to uranium-233, and uranium-233 would then be a source of power. And someday that may be a way that we produce energy by doing that. But you still have the fission products that are the enemy. I mean, the radioactive materials, a fission of uranium-233 produces the same spectrum of different radioactive isotopes that are the thing that causes the decay heat that gives us the problem to cool it, and are the health problem when they get released to the environment. So there really is not a benefit, as I see it, to that relative to the way we produce our energy.
John, thanks for your call.
Okay.
Thanks. Take care. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org to speak to Rich Denning. Mike from the Short North, you're on the air with Richard Denning.
Yeah, I've always been in favor of nuclear energy because there's a death from coal-burning fire plants and everything else because of particulate matter, carbon dioxide, and all this other stuff. But now I'm beginning to wonder, and I can't help but to think, okay, so maybe we should have made these foolproof against both an earthquake and a tsunami, and the next generation will say, okay, well, let's make it foolproof against an earthquake and a tsunami and a meteor strike all at once, and we'll come up with all these scenarios. And yet I'm thinking, isn't there going to be that, whoops, the one thing we didn't think about, this occurrence of events, well, it didn't occur to us that maybe this would have degraded and wouldn't happen when that, that kind of very mundane, very plain stuff. And can we ever make them safe?
Yeah, and I think you've actually put your finger on something that's really important, and that is you have to put the risk into perspective. I mean, there's nobody in the United States, no member of the public, ever has died from an accident in a nuclear power plant. If we were to have, another Three Mile Island, that's not, nobody's going to die as a result of that. And yet hundreds of thousands of people have died over the last 40 years prematurely from the use of coal for producing electricity. It's true for every source of electricity. There are risks to human health associated with them. But I think one other thing that's difficult for the layperson to really recognize is that they get very concerned because they hear nuclear, they hear about radiation, they think that an accident is going to be catastrophic, and even our worst, I analyze at very low probabilities what can happen in a severe accident, and the reality is it just not is a not that it can't be fairly, a big expense, lead to radiation exposures, but it's so rare that you're willing to take some risk that you'll have an accident. But as far as protection of the environment, protection of people, we really provide very good protection so that even if accidents occur, we would not expect to see off-site fatalities as a result of them. So I think you have to maintain the perspective that there are risks in life in everything that you do. And the nuclear power plant accident is extremely undesirable event to happen. But taking the risk that you can have one, it just is not of the level of catastrophe as we're seeing due to the seismic event itself, and the I don't know how many people are now being assumed that have died in Japan, but there's going to be nobody that dies in Japan from direct exposure to the radiation.
Mike, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yep. 614-292-8513, but we only have a few more minutes left. And Lori from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Lori.
Oh, hi. I was wondering if there are still any ground contamination from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and did the United States build the GE reactors there after World War II?
Well, first of all, there is still contamination worldwide where you can actually still see some things that happen from our weapons program. In that area, there aren't any areas of high contamination still left in Nagasaki or Hiroshima. And did we build the reactors?
Mm-hmm.
It basically is our technology, and General Electric in the United States built the first of those reactors. But the Japanese, of course, that are very technologically sophisticated, now have the capability to design new designs and new reactors and things like that. But yes, the first designs were American designs, and they really didn't occur until the early 60s.
Thank you, Lori, for that call. And Randy in London, London, Ohio. Welcome to the show. Just in case anyone wondered,
I'm wondering what kind of event would have to take place where we in Ohio would be exposed to radioactive iodine or some other exposure.
Yeah.
I think probably iodine would be the highest risk.
Iodine can be a high risk. Again, cesium is definitely a bad actor, but there are a handful of ones. As far as where you're located, we understand we have nuclear power plants near Toledo, near Cleveland, but the reality is the risks even in close to those reactors are very small relative to the risks that people have from other common day occurrences. So as far as you're concerned, where you are, there's no way that an accident at those plants is going to have any effect on your life. Even if you had the big accident at one of those plants, it's not going to affect your life or risk to you. People that are closer to the plant have a higher risk. But again, even those people have a risk that's extremely small relative to the other risks that they are exposed to.
Okay, Randy, thanks a lot for that call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I want to say thanks to my guest, Richard Denning, OSU Nuclear Engineering Professor. Rich, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Thanks for listening today. Thanks to everybody who helped put this show together, including my producer, Linda Taylor, the associate producer, Amy Jurovich, student production assistant, Jeff Steiner, WOSU radio intern, Leticia Wiggins, radio operations director, Kevin Petrilla, senior broadcast technician, Eric French. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from CTL Engineering, proud of its more than 80 years of service providing consulting engineering and laboratory testing services. More information online at ctleng.com.